My fundamental belief is that leaders might be scarce. So in your company, there might only be one CEO, only five vice presidents. But leadership is abundant. That we need to start shifting from leadership as a title to leadership as an act. I think when we start seeing it that way, that makes it much more inclusive, much more approachable for all of us, no matter sort of our background, where we've come from. A fundamental belief of the book is that we can each be change makers. But I think it starts with changing that narrative about what it means to be a leader.
Thanks for being on the show.
Becoming a change maker, I have my friend, old friend, longtime friend, Alex Budak here. Welcome to Seed Stories, buddy. It's good to see you.
Hey, John, it's really good to see you, and thank you for having me.
You and I grew up in the mean streets of Palo Alto, California.
you can't even get it out without a giggle, yeah.
Something in the water there. You know, like a lot of great entrepreneurs and professors like yourself, book writers coming from that area. I'm going to get into the content of your new excellent book, which I loved, Becoming a Changemaker. But before I do that, I always like to start off Seed Stories with a little bit of a backstory. So if you don't mind, paint a picture of what it was like for you growing up as my neighbor in Palo Alto, California.
Palo Alto is a funny place to grow up, I think. And in some ways, it's sort of like the fish in water that doesn't necessarily know that it's wet. I think maybe the same for us, that I don't think what you realize, really, I didn't realize at the time quite how unique Palo Alto was. You and I, of course, went to one of the most competitive public high schools in the country, a place where there's just so much pressure to thrive and where concepts of success, I think, are totally distorted. But also surrounded by like so many interesting, innovative, question the status quo, changemaker type of people. And I think that's a really powerful thing that I didn't fully appreciate until I got out of Palo Alto and then was sort of looking back and going, oh, so the rest of the world isn't like this? So I think in the moment.
I mean, I always like people ask me my bio and I'm like, well, first and foremost, I won the lottery and I grew up in Palo Alto, California. And so, yeah, look, I think you're right. You know, we were blessed with having Stanford right next door and Cal, where you teach now. And I want to get into that a little bit about your burgeoning career as a professor. But, you know, you graduated from Gunn, you went off to undergraduate. I guess, take us through a little bit of a journey of like your professional career. How did you wind up in as a book writer and professor and entrepreneur? And like when you were growing up playing in the sandbox, be like, I always wanted to do this.
Well, you'll remember this from our days in high school, but along with a few of our buddies, we started something called the Sixth Man Club. So that was the group that went to the basketball games, the football games, and were crazy and rowdy and cheered people on. And that was kind of my first streak of entrepreneurship without really knowing about it. There was no business model behind it, but just this idea of like rallying people behind something, like setting a vision and getting people involved. So I've always sort of had that entrepreneurial streak, but I didn't really know what to do with it. So I did university at UCLA, where, by the way, that streak of cheering on basketball teams continued. And then went out to Washington.
I'll be in a much better basketball team than
a much higher level.
Gunn High School.
And went out to Washington, D.C., because I was really passionate about education policy, about public education. But I think once I got out to DC, I realized I was probably a little bit too entrepreneurial for the way that most of the students in my program thought about things. I mean, I met most incredible people, but a lot of their sort of vision of change centered around working at the big institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, and there's a role for that, to be sure. But I spent a little time between my first and second year of graduate school living and working in India. I was in Ahmedabad, India, in the state of Gujarat in the West. And while I was there, I did some volunteer work with a local grassroots organization. It worked with girls from the local community and used sport as a tool for teaching healthy habits and leadership. And I think it was there that I had my first sort of realization around change making. And I realized that there's change makers quite literally all around the world, people who want to start good, that want to do good things, but just too many barriers getting in the way. It was my first introduction to what we now call social entrepreneurship, kind of using the tools of entrepreneurship, but towards social aims. And that's where that light bulb went off for me, that I finally realized, okay, I do have this entrepreneurial streak, but now I also have the why behind it, like the reason to put it into action. So from there, I came back to Washington, D.C., sort of one foot in graduate school and the other foot sort of starting to think about my own entrepreneurial journey. And as you know, you so often talk about on your pod, you know, I think the best founders just fall in love with, get obsessed with a problem that they just have to solve. And I kept thinking back to this girls' sports club in Ahmedabad, India, and realizing that we need these change makers all around the world to take action. And the change won't come from a big institution, it'll come from lots of us. But how do we get those people started? And so this was in the sort of techno-optimism days of the early 2010s and connected with my co-founder around how technology might drive social change and about how we might be able to build some of the tools to help changemakers all around the world get started.
I want to go a little bit off script and say, give a definition for changemakers, because we are now, this is a term that is now in the zeitgeist, thanks to you. And I want you to give our listeners kind of a definition. I guess we call this the gray box in the book here to give some people some more color on what you mean when you say changemaker.
Yeah, thanks. So I define it in a radically inclusive way. So I simply define a changemaker is someone who leads positive change from where they are. You'll see in that definition that there's no mention of roles or titles or even the scale of change. I believe that a Nobel Prize winner has just as much of a claim to the title as a product manager who's pushing things forward, who's questioning the status quo in some ways. And so I hope that it's an inclusive identity that you can sort of layer onto your existing ones. So you could be a changemaker founder, you could be a changemaker climate scientist, a changemaker artist, changemaker engineer, that each of us can sort of see a bit of ourselves and our ability to lead change from wherever we might be.
Now, I want to get back to your story, but I guess if I'm sitting here as an Amazon delivery guy or gal, or I'm in a difficult place in my life where maybe I'm out of work, Alex, does this concept apply to me? Like, or do I have to be, you know, did I have to win the lottery and grow up in Palo Alto, California, or did I, you know, have to be blessed by making it into an Ivy League institution?
Yeah, 100%. Such an important question, John. And, you know, to be clear, we should recognize the privileges that we have, that it's easier to be a change maker when you have some of those resources. But I think my fundamental belief, and the reason I wrote this book, is that I think so much of the way that we talk about leadership, the way that we teach leadership, is just broken. That when we think about leadership, we tend to put the solo leader up on this pedestal. And, you know, we tell the stories of Bezos or Zuckerberg or Gates or Musk or whomever. And I think when we focus on leadership through that lens, we can say, well, I'm not naturally that charismatic. I'm not naturally outgoing. I don't have their resources. So that means I can't be a leader. And I think, unfortunately, and this is something that's perpetuated by a lot of business schools, is that when we talk about leadership in that way, it feels really exclusive. And I think for so long, we've mistaken the way we think about leadership, that my fundamental belief is that leaders might be scarce. So in your company, there might only be one CEO, only five vice presidents, but leadership is abundant, that we need to start shifting from leadership as a title to leadership as an act. I think when we start seeing it that way, that makes it much more inclusive, much more approachable for all of us, no matter sort of our background, where we've come from. A fundamental belief of the book is that we can each be change makers. But I think it starts with changing that narrative about what it means to be a leader.
Decentralized leadership, if I was to coin a new, very in vogue term using. Okay, back on track. So we're starting our social entrepreneurship career. Get us in the mindset of Alex Budak, you know, building this organization.
So, like so many of the founders that you probably know, I just got obsessed with this idea. You know, it's the idea that I would think about when I was in the shower, think about when I got up in the morning, and how could technology make it accessible for more people to start doing good? And my co-founder, Tom, and I recognized a couple of things that just really bothered us, like a conflict with our values. And so the first was that when it comes to starting a social venture, we often say, okay, write this grant application. And we ask 100 entrepreneurs to write grants. And then there's one person sitting in a room by themselves that says yes to one of them and no to 99. And we think that's fundamentally broken, because who knows better what a community needs than the community itself? So we wanted to shift those power dynamics to be more community driven. And then the second gap that we saw is that it's never easy to raise money to be a social entrepreneur, but you usually have to prove you have an impact. But how do you prove you have an impact until you have the money to launch a pilot to create that impact in the first place? And so based off of those two sort of problems, which again felt like deeply personal to me as an emerging, budding social entrepreneur, we created Start Some Good, which is a crowdfunding site, kind of the early days of crowdfunding, to focus on helping people, especially early stage social entrepreneurs, get that initial capital they need to get going. And so sometimes people would use our site and raise hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that's great. But honestly, I was equally excited, if not more excited, about the times people would come and raise $300 on our site. I think about a group of high schoolers in Oakland, California. They wanted to start an urban garden. And literally all the money they needed was just money for soil, for seeds, for beds. And that $200, $300 is all that it took from them having an idea to actually being able to take action on it. And to me, that was super meaningful, is unlocking that ability for each of us to become change makers.
How do you, for our listener, define or describe social entrepreneurship versus the entrepreneurship we read about in TechCrunch? Or are they blurred, and or are they becoming more blurred? The conversation around environmental social responsibility and climate and obviously diversity and inclusion, you know, these areas seem to all be coming to the forefront of how companies are being built today. So I guess the question is like, how would you define the difference between those two in your mind?
So I think it's a really wonderful thing that the lines are starting to get blurred. Back when I got started about 10 years ago, it was like very distinct. Either you're a social entrepreneur or you're a traditional business entrepreneur. And I think it's a really healthy thing that it's starting to blur. But the way that I would differentiate is that I think a social entrepreneur uses the tools of entrepreneurship to fundamentally solve a social challenge. There's many entrepreneurs, and this isn't a bad thing, but the reason you exist is to continue on, to keep scaling, to keep growing. But I think truly a social entrepreneur takes this sort of systems lens, this systems change approach that says, I actually want to put myself out of business. Like, I want to be in this until this problem is solved for good, and then I'm no longer needed and I'll move on to the next thing. And so within that, on the like very traditional entrepreneurship and the hardcore social entrepreneurship on one end, there's this wonderful gray area in between. And that's where, as you mentioned, so many impact-driven startups, from DEI-focused to climate justice-focused, we need those. And I think it's really exciting to see that so many more startups, so many entrepreneurs are taking that lens of impact in what they do.
From my perspective as an investor, it's really interesting to see the quality and caliber of folks that are trying to tackle these major problems now. And one of the things that I guess I would say Green Tech 1.0 in Silicon Valley got wrong was, let's just throw money at this problem and that'll solve it. But I think you need a combination of great talent, innovation, really sort of the infrastructure in the government and policy and all these things. And that requires like a level of dynamic abilities that you can learn in the book, by the way. And, but also, really only comes from people that kind of care about solving those kind of challenges. So, okay. So you started the company. Take us through like how that all went, what challenges you had, what worked, what didn't. You know, mostly Seed Stories is about entrepreneurship, you know, in sort of the traditional sense. But I like your story because it does take a different approach. So maybe, what did you learn? What worked? What didn't?
Oh, I mean, what a roller coaster. As any of your people watching that are entrepreneurs right now themselves know, I mean, it is just a constant up and down. Sometimes up and downs multiple times in the same day. So what a thing to like get this company off the ground, and then, you know, so many failures. We can talk about this. It's something I'm really passionate about teaching, is like how we learn and grow from our failures. And so as I reflect back, I mean, a couple of things that just were like major learning moments for me. I remember in the early days of Start Some Good, as we were just getting going. So I was, of course, the hungry, eager entrepreneur. I was working at all kinds of crazy hours of the night, midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., sending emails. And at the time, we had a team. So we had kind of the core team. And we had a few interns. And the interns were definitely paid, because I think that's important to make sure people are paid. But, you know, not paid says especially well. And I would be sending emails at 1 a.m. And I would see these interns were sending me emails back at 1 a.m. And it was like a gut punch to me. I was like, why are you doing this? I never told you to send me emails at 1 a.m. But I also realized that I never told them not to. That I never told them, like, my expectation, I never wanted them to send an email after 5 p.m. Like, you should have your evenings off. Like, I'm the crazy one. You don't have to worry about it. But I learned very quickly. And again, like a true gut punch, like I felt so badly. But I learned is that your company, your organization, it's going to have a culture whether you define it or not. So it's so important to be proactive about defining that culture. And that's something I had failed in. I didn't think enough about it. And so people were following my lead, because of course they would. And that's a lesson I learned the hard way, is that you've got to be really deliberate about the culture that you try to create. So simultaneously, part of the reason that I wasn't sleeping very well, or was working so many late nights, is we had this sort of like grandiose vision, right? So I was inspired by my time in India. And we said, we want change makers all around the world to get started. And this is, again, the early days of sort of fintech and crowdfunding. And so we were rolling our own payment processing platform using PayPal and doing chain payments and delayed payments, like all these things that were like just crazy hacking it together. If you were to start a crowdfunding site now, you have so much more infrastructure in place. You've got Stripe and other companies, like way easier. But as a result, we were really pushing the envelope on what technology made possible. And think about the complexity. So we had people who were maybe living in Mexico, who are donating to a social entrepreneur based in Thailand through a company based in the US. Like, it's crazy the complications that we were bringing into this. And as a result, perhaps not surprisingly, I spent so much time on the phone with tech support, so much so that I'm not even kidding. I became on a first name basis, and I knew who the people were on the tech line that I wanted to talk to, because they were the best and they would actually help me. So we kept breaking things. And I think what I realized there is that we were so eager to be like huge scale from day one that like we added so much complexity and so much pain, whereas we probably would have been better off scaling our vision down a little bit and like just getting traction in one country, or maybe even just in like a couple cities to start with, like get that going and then build from there. So I think on one hand, we had like that eagerness, which is a great trait in a social entrepreneur, but perhaps lacked a little bit of the patience to sort of say, okay, let's build this step by step and like, let's get there, but like, let's not drive ourselves crazy in the first couple months.
I mean, gosh, there's so much that resonates there with me, and somewhat PTSD. I'm trying not to get, you know, into like a shivering, you know, fetal position right now. But what's funny about first-time entrepreneurs, and I'm not saying that the Six-Man Club was not your first startup, because I do remember you guys had real strong product market fit at the games. But the ambition of first-time founders is often like insane, right? Because they don't know what they don't know. And they usually drive some of the biggest outcomes, whether that be through social change or a product or a service, whatever that might be. Second or third time founders, significantly more reliable as far as like not taking major risks, higher probability of success, smaller outcomes. So statistically, you were in the majority by banging your head against the wall on some silly things out of the gate. At what point did you get the kernel in your head, like, I need to write this book and like tell everybody about how to become a change maker? Because I remember you talking about this. I remember getting some email newsletters with you along the way, and we had coffee in Stockholm. Gosh, that must have been 6-7 years ago, a while ago. You never warned me about the winters. But I remember you talking about this concept. And so tell me, like, how did you come up with the sort of like, you know, the inner desire to like spread the gospel, as it were?
Well, yeah, it's nice to kind of have that transition to Sweden. Sorry about that, but I think that's part of the hazing of a California kid moving to Sweden. Because when my then girlfriend, now wife, Rebecca and I, when we first visited Sweden, thinking about moving there, we visited in July, which is the most amazing time to visit Sweden. You've got these long summer nights. We fell more in love with each other, in love with the city. And then we moved in January, and I've never been colder in my life. So,
It's like light for like 3 hours a day. Yeah.
exactly, seasonal. So, moved to Stockholm, moved to Sweden, and decided, still trying to run, start some good at that point. And at that point, we had a team, a few of us in the US, a few of us in Australia, where my co-founder is from. And if you can think about like the worst possible geographic location to try to run a global team based in the US and Australia, Sweden would probably be it. And so I remember we would lead team meetings where the only time we could all meet would be 2 a.m. Stockholm time. And so I'd lead this meeting in our tiny little Swedish apartment. My wife, Rebecca, would be sleeping on the other side of this, tiny apartment. And I'd be almost leading in a whisper to not wake her up. And the sun would sometimes still be up when we started the meeting. It would dip down. And then by the time we ended the meeting, the sun would have risen again. And it's like daytime. And I just finished the meeting. I was like, okay, this is not working. I've got to get, but also wanted to get involved in the local community in Sweden. And so I started making the transition a little bit from the lens of social entrepreneur to sort of how can each of us create change from where we are? And that's where I started thinking about this more inclusive term of change maker. Many people in your community are entrepreneurs, budding entrepreneurs, and that's an amazing way to leave a dent in the universe. But that's not for all of us. And I wanted a more inclusive way to think about it for the CFO or the COO, the person that wants to lead change, but maybe in a slightly different way. And that's where the concept of change maker came to me, this belief that we can all lead change in ways true to who we are. So moved back to the San Francisco Bay Area, and through a bunch of good fortune, had a chance to start a job at UC Berkeley. And at Berkeley, I got the chance to teach this class, which is a dream come true. I kind of pitched this idea, and I'm so grateful that they believed in this idea, a class called Becoming a Change Maker. And so that's, of course, the title of the book as well. But I started teaching this class, which is all about like, how can we take lessons from the fields of entrepreneurship and innovation and leadership and social impact and kind of tie it all together in a way that equips people with the tools, knowledge, and even the courage to start get going. So, I love teaching. We can talk more about that. But in terms of the book, I have to say, I'm a reluctant author. Like, there's some people who go into this, I've got to write a book, or I'm going to write 10 books. That's not me. I never expected to write a book, as the longest thing I'd written before that was like a very mediocre thesis. Like, I'm not a writer. But enough of my students would come up to me like, this is life-changing. Like, this changed my whole trajectory. Like, you've got to turn this into a book. And I sort of ignored the first few students who said that. But then after like a couple dozen, I started being like, okay, well, maybe there's something there. And so maybe I can be of service here, and maybe we can get the lessons out from Berkeley and get it out to more and more people around the world. And that's really the thing that drove me to write it.
Yeah, I mean, like jam-packed with so much tactical advice. I think when you read a business book or a sort of a nonfiction piece, I feel like a lot of it is like theory, and in many cases, like these lofty stories that don't really apply. But like one of the things I wrote in bold here, and next to it is actually my daughter stole this and like drew on it, but it says Changemaker Canvas, which is one of my favorite tools in the book, which is like, it's at the very end. So if you buy the book, you have to read all the way to the end. But it actually provides like an entire framework that I could see as like a spreadsheet or a Google Doc that somebody could use to start wherever they are and like have all of the tool, like the tools in the shed to start making change. So like not only do you have stories, but you have the tools. And one of my favorite quotes that you have in the book, which I wanted to share with the audience, was life shrinks or expands according to one's courage. And that was by Anis Nin, if I'm saying that correctly. What struck you about that quote that you wanted to include it as kind of near the end?
One of the things that it's been wonderful to see about my class is that when I ask students, like, what do they get out of the class? So many of them mention courage, that they get the courage they need to get started. But I don't actively teach courage. I teach courage as sort of a byproduct of all the other lessons. But I think at some point, to be a changemaker, you've got to find that courage. I'm inspired by the work that Brené Brown does. She writes a lot about vulnerability. What she says is that vulnerability and courage go hand in hand, that there's no act of courage that doesn't also have vulnerability as part of it. She's looked for it, but she just hasn't found it. And she says there's this great paradox that we see vulnerability as strength in other people. We love when we can talk openly and sort of share our vulnerabilities, but we see it as weakness in ourselves. And as I think about my own changemaker journey, there's a lot of, in moments of courage, actually a lot of vulnerability. Those of you that have started your own company, you can probably relate to this. That moment where I go into the DNS settings and I flip the switch and we go live, that's a moment of courage, but it's also a moment of vulnerability where it's like, I've told all my family and friends about this thing. I've got users lined up. Is this thing going to crash? Is this thing going to fail? Are people going to hate my idea? Like, it's courage, but it's also vulnerability. As I think about like all the change makers whom I admire, the change efforts I've seen in my students, people I know, courage unlocks that. And you need the skills, you need the frameworks, which we can talk more about, but also you need that bit of courage to sort of take that leap.
Just playing devil's advocate here, if you look at sort of the cascade of bad news that's occurred recently, with whether it be in organizations falling apart, countries falling apart, companies falling apart, layoffs occurring, economy spiraling out of control, I feel like people want the pilot to come on and say, we're hitting a bit of turbulence here and everything's going to be okay. And you're like, we just dropped like 4,000 feet in like 10 seconds. Like, I feel like I'm going to die. My challenge to you is like, what's the right level of vulnerability? Because part of me thinks that you're right, that it's important to share, to show that you're human. But if I'm looking up to a leader, I want them to seem like they have their, pardon my French, shit together, you know?
For sure. And so Brené Brown, she says, vulnerability without boundaries leads to disconnection, distrust, and disengagement. So you can't just have like pure vulnerability. But I think what I want to point to here is that as change makers, we actually need to hold multiple polarities at the same time. So I read a chapter about this, this idea of confidence without attitude. And so I think to be a great change maker, you've got to do sort of a both and. So I make the case that you've got to be confident, right? To start anything meaningful, you've got to have the confidence to like stand up and say like, I've got something worth talking about. Like I have a voice here. Like I have a belief. I've got something. Like that takes confidence. But you also need humility. You need the humility to admit when you might be wrong, to be vulnerable enough to bring other people along with you, to admit mistakes, to bring out the best in others. But I think we often make the mistake where you try to go like, okay, I'm just going to be a little bit confident and a little bit humble. And I'll find that sort of in-between zone. But I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. I think what you want to do is a both and. So what we truly want, we want leaders who are confident and humble, that they're both of those things. I think that's what we're really looking for in our leaders. In the book, I tell the story of an entrepreneur, Gwen Yi Wong. So she's based in Malaysia. And by all outward stories, she was thriving. Her company, Tribeless, was taking off. Tons of media coverage, magazine covers, like doing super well. But inside, she sort of felt this tension. She had realized that the company had grown to a place where she was no longer the leader that her team and her company needed. She's sort of the visionary. She's the product person. But the team needed someone who's more of an operator, a finance person. And she felt this like great discordance with like who she actually is and who she needed to be. She decided after a number of difficult conversations with her co-founder and her team to actually step back from the CEO role. Her co-founder stepped up and she took on more of a product vision role. And I like telling her story because I think this is what we want to see more of in our leaders and our change makers. So she has a ton of confidence, right? She founded this company. She grew it, high growth, impressive leader. But she also had the humility to know, okay, at this point, I'm no longer the leader that's best serving my team. So she had the humility to step back. But even in that act of humility was still the confidence, sort of the confidence to say, like, I'm still going to steer this. I'm still going to make sure the right person steps up and we better as we go. And this was before the pandemic. She stepped back. And then her timing could not have been more perfect because come the pandemic in April of 2020, they were able to pivot into a completely virtual delivery, and she was able to use her product mind to make that pivot. So I think that's an example of where it's not somewhere in between. Imagine if Gwen were just a little bit confident, never got the startup to its full potential, and also a little bit humble, where she kind of never listened to her weaknesses or thinking, oh, I could just figure this out. No, she was both confident and humble. And I think that's what makes a difference.
Like, I'm much better served as a product person. I have confidence that I can do that. And I'm, and both, you know, and I think it's better for the organization that I step aside. I mentioned before we started, I meet hundreds of entrepreneurs a month. And one of the things I always ask them is like, why do you want to be CEO or leading a company? And invariably, and you have a great story about this actually, about the kid in the suit, which I want to get to. Invariably I get this like, oh, I've always wanted to do this role. And I was like, this is the most awful job in the entire, it's one of the worst jobs you could ever have. Cause you're like, oh, I'm the one in charge. And I'm like, no. Your employees are in charge. Your investors are in charge. Your customers are in charge. And like, it just goes on and on and on and on.
And when anything goes wrong, you've got to go find a way to solve it and fix it on top of that. Yeah. It's a really, really hard job.
And not only that, but like, you know, people are always like, oh, well, if I just get this next round of funding or this next grant or whatever, then all my problems will solve. But I'm like, actually, what happens is your problems go from once a month to once a week to once a day to once an hour, the more scale you get. So I think the humble leaders part was one of my favorites because, again, you brought real data to the story. And there was a study that was done about humble leaders as defined by language and process and their approach. And the data was like crystal clear. Reduced pay disparities, more diverse leadership teams, less turnover, high employee satisfaction. Most importantly, bottom line. And I think that that was really cool to see. And you also reflected on the sort of work that Jim Collins had done in Good to Great, which I think, you know, he's one of the most storied coaches and executives in the Valley, and like something that he talks a lot about being a mirror and a window. So I think that is a lot of people are in many cases in startups and in that world trying to like be the Steve Jobs. But I think that sort of time, that bygone era is a bit in the past. There's a story that you talk about in the book that I want you to touch on. And again, I don't want you to give away too much, but there's a perception that people have about being a change maker or being an entrepreneur. They see the press, they see the headlines, the TechCrunch articles. You had a kid show up to a meeting with you in a three-piece suit. I want you to tell that story.
Yeah, we were going for a walk and talk meeting, which is my favorite kind of meeting. And I love mentoring young entrepreneurs, young change makers. And so he showed up and there I am in like, you know, shorts and a t-shirt, I'm a pretty casual guy. And he showed up in a three-piece suit, like ready to impress. And we started walking. It was in San Francisco, so walking up the steep hills of the city. And pretty quickly in our conversation, he made clear to me what his goal was. His goal was, I want to be on the Forbes 30 under 30 list. He said, how could I get on that list? And I was sort of taken aback. So I asked him, well, what are you going to do to be on the 30 under 30 list? What are you going to have achieved? He had no idea. He didn't know what he wanted to do. He just really wanted to be on that list. And so I told him, and you know, the best balance I could of being direct, but also honest and empathetic. He'd mistaken the means for the ends. You know, he was so focused on the outcome, he forgot about the process to actually get there. I told him in that moment that you can't ultimately control what happens, whether you get on a list. You know, you could be among the people worthy of that honor, but there's still going to be people sitting in a conference room in New York City that are going through a list of very talented folks, and they choose 30 of them, and maybe you're selected, maybe you're not. You can't control that. You just can't control that. What you can control, though, is doing meaningful work and serving others, finding a problem worth solving, finding someone worth helping, and taking action. If you do that, I can't promise you'll be on the Forbes 30 under 30 list. But more importantly, you will have done meaningful work. And if you do meaningful work, maybe it will lead to some of that press coverage that you want. But much more importantly, you will have done something meaningful and actually helped people along the way.
I love that. And it reminds me of my internship days when I would show up to the Cushman & Wakefield office in San Francisco wearing my pleated pants and my polo shirt tucked in. It's like schwitzing every time I would walk to the office in San Francisco. there's a concept in I guess I would say Silicon Valley and just more broadly speaking about being a contrarian, right? And it's a little bit like, I think, somewhat of an overused term, and a lot of people don't actually know what it means. Like they just say, if I just say some like wild and audacious stuff on Twitter, that makes me a contrarian. And then in the venture capital business, there's kind of this concept of being contrarian and being right makes for outlier type investments and returns. And that means like, you know, when Zuck showed up to all of the VC's office in sandals and shorts and, you know, was a little bit, you know, strange. a lot of people passed on him, except for, you know, Accel and Founders Fund, and a few other who were contrarian and right. So another thing that you talk about in the book that I really enjoyed was about how to really question the status quo, like tactically. And I'd love for you to give us a little bit on dose on that one, because it's talked about so often now, I don't think people are doing it the right way. And you prescribe like a really specific way of going about it.
Yeah, for sure. And so you frame it up. You know, one of the concepts is this idea of zigging when others zag. This is when it works well. So it's sort of spotting trends. It's not just being like, I'm just going to take chances and just guess a whole bunch of things and hope that one out of those 100 are right. And like, then I look good by being a contrarian. But rather like, when you see everyone going one way, can you go the other way? Think here of the outdoor retailer REI. On Black Friday, when every other company was trying to open as early as they possibly could on Friday morning, leading into Thursday on Thanksgiving, they said, no, we're going to do opt outside. You can't even buy stuff from us if you want to. Go outside, go be with your family. By the way, we'll still pay our retail staff and then come back to us later. And they found is that when they sort of bucked that trend, not only was it great for brand sentiment, super positive sentiment on social media, also increased revenues. So there's opportunities to kind of go your own way. But it's not just about like the risks that we see. It's about taking smart risks, not just about challenging everything, being smart in what we challenge. So there's a tool I love, which I especially use with executives that I teach. It's called the risk quotient. When I teach it, when I talk about it here, it's going to sound deceptively simple, but it's a really powerful tool. I find that in working with executives, it's not that any one single risk stresses them out. It's the sheer number of them and knowing when is it worth sort of putting my capital on the line to take that risk. So put simply, the risk quotient is potential rewards over potential losses. So what you do is you start by sort of qualitatively identifying them. In my class, I just use kind of an extreme example of running a red light. You know, so what are the benefits to running a red light qualitatively and ask people to share? And so it's, you know, saving a bit of time. I invariably have one or two people say something like, it's a thrill, it's fun. And so I say, okay, stay away from those folks on the road. So, you know, a couple of benefits to that. Potential losses, well, you know, you could get a ticket, you could injure someone, you could kill someone, you could injure yourself. And so then we quantify. So 1 to 10, what are those rewards? And 1 to 10, what are those losses? And just that act of doing so can help us get some clarity over whether this is a risk that's worth taking or not. That's a simple example. But for instance,
so let's play that one out. So like potential loss of killing somebody is a 10.
Yeah.
And the reward is probably 2 or 3, like maybe it's a little bit of time. So it's like, what is that?
I ask is like 1.5. Yeah. 1.5 probably.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So my risk quotient there was, what's that? You're the math guy here. 1 over 10, 10%. So the higher the risk quotient, the more likely you go through with the, oh, sorry. There's a scale here, right? We go greater than 3. Is that the trick?
Yeah, that's the technical trick, according to the founder of it. But I mean, you use it as like a decision matrix for yourself. Each of us will have different values, different risk tolerances. And so decide on it based off of that, but at least be clear on what you're talking about. You can even use it as a team as well, have people fill it out for themselves. And then it becomes a discussion point to say, well, I think it's a, you know, a 3.5, I think it's a 7, whatever. At least use that as a place to have those conversations instead of just like, you know, taking a guess and going, oh, this is how we're going to be contrarian today. Like, no, be smart in taking our risks, I think.
And also, like, the way that you talk about dialing up your curiosity really resonated with me in becoming a contrarian, right? Like, you can't just zig and zag and assume the risks, right? Like, you need to do your homework, right? Which is, like, you know, asking a bunch of questions and, you know, just getting way into the weeds on exactly why you're doing, you know, taking this bet, you know, sort of really digging into the details. I think the folks who start something, whether it be social entrepreneurship or, you know, technology entrepreneurship or policy change, know something that others don't. So one of my favorite stories is a gal named Sonia Trauss. She started a movement called the YIMBY movement, which was called Yes in My Backyard. And originally it was started off in San Francisco in the early 2010s as BARF, which was the Bay Area Renters Foundation. And she made it like this like terrible sounding concept to like get people to talk about it or write about it, but then realized quickly that like it wouldn't turn into a movement if she didn't do that. But what she found was that there was this underground like crew of renters who were actually, they just wanted to see their rent fall. They didn't care if more expensive high rises went up or affordable housing projects went up or whatever. They believed in the laws of supply and demand, good old fashioned supply and demand. And she had like done all this poll work and all this research and was like super contrarian by getting this crew together and super curious about it. I remember I wrote a blog post in 2015 that Silicon Valley needs to stop making photo sharing apps and start solving real problems. And she's like, well, bro, you're writing a blog post about it. Why don't you go do something? So I was like, okay. So then I met with her and it was so clear that she had, like you said, dialed up her curiosity to the point where she had done all of this research, obviously zigged when others zagged. The reward for taking this risk was massive. So if she gets a movement of people going to push for more housing projects by showing up to planning departments and saying yes to every project, that was really big. And the loss was like, what was it, time? Or somebody's tomato garden would get shaded in San Francisco or New York? Doesn't seem like it's that big of a loss. So I think your framework really applies. And then obviously, fast forward to today, and Politico named it one of the biggest political movements in the United States. And I think that, like, you know, across the country, all sorts of zoning laws are being completely repealed because of the work that YIMBY did. So I really like that from a contrarian perspective. Well, there is a ton more that we can touch on, and I'm going so into the weeds on what you've written, and I want people to pick up a copy. And but I would love to finish on one of my favorite exercises that you do with your classes, which is the go fail slide. Tell us a little bit about that.
One of my favorites too. So there's this ethos in Silicon Valley about learning from failure, but you know, it's one thing to just intellectualize it. So we spend a lecture at Berkeley where we talk about failure and good failures. We do some case studies. We look at some empirical research, some frameworks. And then towards the end of lecture, I put up a slide which just has two words. Go fail. And students start kind of looking around like, what's going on? I put up the next slide and I go, okay, you've got 10 minutes. You have to go leave the classroom and you've got to go get rejected. You cannot come back to the classroom until you've asked for something and gotten a no. And my students start like responding somatically. Like I see them at the front of the classroom. I see them like turning red and sweating. And they're like nervous and giggling. Like, is this for real? I'm like, yeah, this is for real. I say, look, you know, I'll be at the front of the room. If you need a little coaching, a little mentoring, like I'll be here, I'll help you. But like, I'm serious. 10 minutes, go leave the classroom, go get rejected. And so these students walk out, like, really nervous, like, kind of shuffling their feet, like, being dragged out of the classroom. But then when they come back, the energy is off the charts. So much so that I once had a professor next door that came over and was like, hey, can you guys keep the noise down? Like, you're getting a little noisy here.
Too rowdy.
Too rowdy. And what we see is a couple of things happen. So about one third of students, they ask for something. They're sure they're going to get rejected. And they actually get a yes. I think about one woman who went to the cafe and she asked for a free orange juice. And she expected a no. But the barista said, okay. And she's like, uh-oh, I'm supposed to fail. Can I have a second orange juice? And she goes, yeah, okay. Can I have three? And finally said no on the third. So about one third of them are so sure that they're failed that often their failure is that we are scared to ask for something and we reject ourselves before we even put ourselves out there. And in the case of the other two thirds, they ask for something and as expected, they get a no. But they find that no one laughed at them. No one made fun of them. It wasn't fatal. You know, they came back and back in those words of Anais Nin, they come back with a bit more courage. Their vision is expanded because they've gotten a no, but they feel good about themselves. They feel proud of themselves. So
they're like relieved. They're like relieved. They're like, I finished the task. Like I failed.
They failed and that they survived it. And then that, as we've seen from other students who have told me afterwards, that opens up their confidence to make bigger asks, right? You start with a small ask. You realize, okay, well, I got a no, but that's all right. Now let me ask for something bigger and bigger. And along the way, you get more failures. You get more no's. But you also get some really powerful yeses. There's a concept which actually was developed at UC Berkeley called the failure paradox, which is that when we look at people who are really successful, we tend to think, oh, wow, like they just really succeeded a whole lot. Like they got a lot of success. Like they're just really talented. But actually the data show that those who succeed a lot also fail a lot. And sometimes the superpower of a change maker, of an entrepreneur, is being willing to endure that failure, to have a greater why behind us, and keep asking and keep asking and keep failing and keep failing, because amidst those failures will be some successes.
Awesome. Are Gen Z kids more or less hopeful than their millennial counterparts? You teach them. Tell me, give me the dirt. What's the story?
What I tell these Gen Z students is you have every reason to feel upset. Like if you look at the world today and you look at like the state of the world that other generations have left you, when you think about income inequality, climate justice, like you have every reason to be upset. But don't let anyone take away your hope. Like you can feel angry. You have every reason to feel angry, but we need you. We need you to feel a sense that tomorrow can be better than today. And I personally have so much confidence in Gen Z. There's recent data that came out that says 77% of them, when they're looking for a job, that they want to find a company that embodies their values, that matches their values, that stands for something, that has social impact. And that gives me so much confidence. And so I tell them, if you feel upset, feel that anger. But perhaps in the words of singer-songwriter Joan Baez, she says, action is the antidote to despair. And so can you find reasons to take action, not in spite of, but perhaps because of that feeling that you have, because that's ultimately what the world needs. It's people stepping up and solving the problems that we're all facing.
I love it. If people want to get a copy of Becoming a Changemaker, they go to their local Amazon.com bookstore. And they can also get your beautiful voice in their ears on an Audible. And anywhere else they can get a copy?
Yes, anywhere you buy books, local bookstores, Barnes & Noble, et cetera. So wherever is comfortable for you, get it. And yeah, I did the audiobook, which was super fun, really hard, but really, really fun to do as well.
Alex, this has been awesome. I could talk to you for hours. There's so many great concepts in this book, and having started a company before and had so many more downs than ups, I wish I had this book before I started, honestly. And it's just been a real pleasure to talk to you. And obviously, you know, you and I have been friends for quite a bit of time, but it's cool to see your career flourish. And I think the future is bright for the Gen Zs of the world and folks who read this book. And I'm excited to see what the folks that you teach come up with. And it's just been a real awesome time to spend time with you on the show today.
John, well, first of all, thank you for being a change maker, whom I deeply admire. And thanks for having me. This was super fun. I enjoyed our conversation today.
Awesome.